Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August 1st, 2002. Today's session is titled, Meeting and Greeting Our Muslim Neighbors, A History of Encounters and Clashes, presented by Harold and Mai Vogelaar. The number is VOH-2002-09. Let's listen in.
This tonight, as far as I know, because it'll be a video. But welcome. I'm Harold Vogelaar, and my wife, Pitsamai, or Mai, from Thailand, from Bangkok. Spent many years in the Middle East and working now at the Lutheran School of Theology. This is the fourth of the five-part series. Tomorrow is the last. At 10:15, we'll talk more about the contemporary scene in the Middle East, as sort of I understand it, as I've been living it. Oh, 10:45, yeah, right. And then we leave on the afternoon bus. So we will have been here 2 weeks. It's been very nice, yeah. We began with the study of Abraham, to see how Muslims root their faith in the faith of Abraham. And then we had a video on the life of Muhammad, for those of you who may have seen that. And then yesterday, Mai talked a bit about the faith and practice of Islam, what it is that Muslims believe, and then how they try to put that into practice in a formal kind of way. Now, obviously, there's a tremendous diversity within the Muslim world of how Islam is practiced, depending on the country and the culture and the people. Today, then, we want to look at this kind of period, which I call the Age of Empires. We have the Islam, as you know, burst out of the Arabian Peninsula, and Muhammad died in 632. By 634, the Muslims had consolidated Arabia, and then they just burst out. And within 100 years, they had an empire all the way from India to the southern border of France. So that was an incredible spread in such a short time, yeah.
What was their, conversion technique that they used?
They didn't try to convert. They conquered. And
That works.
What happened is that if you wanted them to get certain positions, then you had to convert. In other words, there were certain privileges with becoming Muslims. And otherwise, you paid a protection tax, kind of a covenant tax of protected people. And so, you know, the image always is that they put you to the sword, right? And either you converted or you died. Well, in some instances, that may have been the case as they moved eastward into pagan areas. But generally, that's not the way it went at all. They were a very generous sort of conquerors. They didn't destroy. They weren't like the Mongols or the Huns or others, you know, who came and just literally destroyed everything. That's not the way Muslims conquered. And then they stayed and they ruled and they built these fantastic empires. The Umayyad, the Abbasid.
Mine wants to make a comment.
The Thousand and One Nights. Oh, okay, yes, right.
Let me share the way that I heard from my Muslim community about conversions. After the war, we captured the slaves. And when you become slave, you would like to be free. You have to teach us the knowledge that you have. After that, after you taught Muslims about your knowledge, then you will be free. And I think in this kind of treatment that Muslims deal with the slaves, it's kind of impressions that give to people who would like to know more about this group of people, why they do such a thing to the slave. And it's guide them to learn more about Islam. That was my story.
That's your story, okay. The Christian church, of course, was terribly divided at the time, and the Byzantine Empire was very harsh on those they considered to be heretics. For example, the Christians of Egypt and then in Syria and Iraq and so on, who were called the Monophysites. So there was a lot of division within the church, a lot of oppression under Byzantium. And so when the Muslims came, many, many Christians saw them almost as liberators. They didn't realize they were going to stay for so long. But initially, at least, they liberated them. And bishops who had fled to the desert were welcomed back, and property that was confiscated was given back, and so on. So that they were really a benevolent kind of rule. But as Mai said, you were now captives. She calls you slaves, but you were under their rule, right? And you could remain as you were. You could stay a Christian or a Jew or a Zoroastrian. But if you wanted to move up in the ranks and hold certain positions, then the wise thing to do was just to become a Muslim. And in fact, that's really what happened. So that by the 10th century, for example, Egypt, which was predominantly a Christian country, by the 10th century had become predominantly a Muslim country. And it wasn't, you know, by the sword. It was because of financial, economic, political, social incentives that this happened. Well, when we look at tomorrow, when we look at this period here, we begin to see that they look back on a very glorious past. And we'll show that in the video. It's called Islam, Empire of Faith. The second section is on the whole spread of Islam and sort of the civilization that they built. We'll go until 15 minutes to the end, then we'll just stop it wherever we are, and then we'll talk about it. So, okay? Good. How many of you have maybe seen this on PBS? It was on, a year or two ago, maybe. All right, here we go. Mm-hmm. I hope everything works.
His message and the new Arab Empire were transforming twin continents. Now comes a new empire, a political new configuration, driven by a religious and newly defined civilization. This new civilization expanding beyond its own dreams within a period of very short time. Literally, the largest empire civilization had ever known. The Arabic word for conquest, Fatu, literally means openings. Islam sowed the seeds of its faith to the four winds, and a world of opportunities opened before it. But the vast empire's spiritual core remained at its birthplace, the holy city of Mecca. From every corner of the Muslim world, the faithful embarked on the traditional journey to Mecca, a sacred pilgrimage known as the Hajj.
The pilgrimage became a central devotional and ritual feature in Islamic life. In fact, since the life of Muhammad himself, the pilgrimage has symbolized, probably more than any other Islamic ritual activity, unity among all people and equality.
The Hajj set humanity in motion. For the first time since the reign of Alexander the Great, cultures and caravans now flowed freely. Borders closed for 1,000 years opened.
Both ideas and goods went back and forth over incredible distances. Since every Muslim is enjoying once in his life to visit Mecca, it means that there were caravans carrying goods and pilgrims and ideas and people. And they all met together in Mecca once a year, and then things would radiate back home. So if there was an invention that was discovered in Samarkand, it could be within the year that it would be known in Cordoba.
Where pilgrims trod, traders soon followed. Muhammad himself had been a man of commerce, and now the spread of his message brought with it the spread of trade and the Islamic way of life.
incredibly important in the Islamic world simply because of its geographical position. It was, and still is, between West, what we call the West, and what people always call the East. So it was a natural land bridge connecting China to Europe.
In only two centuries, Islam had extended its reach from Spain all the way to the edge of India. It took nearly a year to travel from one end of the Arab Empire to the other. At its heart was a fabled city of wealth. It was called Baghdad. The palaces of ancient Baghdad have been lost over the centuries. But in its glory, it rivaled ancient Athens or Rome. It was a magnificent architectural achievement, the pride of Islam in a new age. One visitor left this account. All the exquisite neighborhoods covered with parks, gardens, villas, and beautiful promenades are filled with bazaars and finely built mosques and baths. They stretch for miles on both sides of the glittering river. But what made this the greatest city of its time was more than just what met the eye. It was the company it kept. Scholars made Baghdad the jewel of the world.
Certainly from the 8th century on, Baghdad was the center of learning in the Islamic world, and all major innovations either came from Baghdad or quickly came to Baghdad because the best people came to Baghdad, the best thinkers, the best philosophers, the best artists.
They came in search of answers to pragmatic questions. The empire's meteoric growth had left its new leaders overwhelmed. They had staggering engineering and logistical problems to contend with. Solving them would take the greatest minds of the day.
And in the new empire now, you are responsible for public hygiene, you are responsible for the marketplace, you are responsible for goods being sold in the marketplace. All of those require some basic elementary sciences. This new civilization having a need for science really stems from the need to run that empire.
The best minds rose to the call. The finest were welcomed at the center of scholarship, Baghdad's renowned House of Wisdom.
It was a magnet for scholars and intellectuals who came and worked in the academies. There were public libraries associated with the palace, and scholars came from all over the empire. And there were scholars from Iran, there were scholars from Byzantium who came. Some were Christians, some were Muslims, some were Jews. And all of these different sort of threads of human knowledge came together in the city of Baghdad.
So the net effect of this is that you've got human individuals from radically different cultural traditions being thrown into the same crucible.
The challenge that greeted these scholars was daunting. The great works of the ancients had to be transformed into a wholly new body of knowledge. Competition for jobs developed within a new intellectual elite.
And from there on, every single scientist is competing for that job. But they were competing among themselves almost just in the same way that modern bureaucrats and modern academicians will fight among themselves.
Scholars were dispatched across the empire to locate as many ancient texts as possible. The first international scientific venture in history. Unlike their Christian counterparts, Muslim thinkers saw no insurmountable contradiction between their faith and the laws governing the natural world. So they embraced Aristotle and Plato, writers the Christian Church considered blasphemous.
So this is the time when we begin to see scientists, bureaucrats, what have you, going and seeking from whatever civilization that had any sciences before, be it the Greek, be it the Indian, be it the Persian, and so on.
From the Hindus came mathematical concepts that guide us today. It was the scholars of the House of Wisdom who developed the system of Arabic numerals, still in use. It is they who translated and transformed the writings of the Greeks and made a gift of them to the modern Western world. The Renaissance had its beginnings in Baghdad.
They managed to assimilate quite a lot of the rich legacy of the Hellenistic world, translated into Arabic initially, which was then made available to all other participants in the new Islamic civilization. Arabic emerges as the language of learning throughout the region. This is a very significant development in human intellectual history.
Having amassed the knowledge, the Muslims now began to challenge it. This was perhaps their most important contribution. The scientific process was born.
They wanted to know why a very intelligent Greek scientist, whose text they were just admiring and they were verifying it, why would he make a mistake in the first place? So they began to dig, was it because he didn't have the right instruments, or is it because he didn't have the right methodology to use the instruments for the verifications of observation? It is this spirit. You see, the spirit of questioning, the spirit of saying that we have to build science constantly on a systematic, consistent basis where we make a physical proposition of how the universe ought to be run, and the mathematical representation of that physical universe ought to match. Now we begin to have what I call the birth of the new Islamic science.
Algebra and trigonometry, engineering and astronomy, countless disciplines integral to our lives today trace their roots to Islamic scientists. More surprising, perhaps, were their innovations in medicine. At a time when Europeans were praying to the bones of their saints to cure their illnesses, Muslim physicians developed an innovative theory that disease was transmitted through tiny airborne organisms, the precursor to the study of germs. They determined that sick patients should be quarantined and then treated. This is the basis of the institution most fundamental to medicine today, the hospital. Funded mainly through religious endowments, Muslim hospitals had separate wards for patients suffering from different kinds of disease. Even mental illness was treated. Their studies of anatomy were so sophisticated that they remained in use by Muslim and European physicians for 600 years. Muslim scientists were especially intrigued by light, lenses, and the physiology of the human eye. The father of optics was a Muslim named Ibn al-Haytham. His work with lenses eventually led to the invention of the modern camera. He produced the first treatise that ventured to explain how the eye actually sees. A thousand years before the West dared to take up the practice, Muslim doctors were removing cataracts surgically, clearing them from the eye with a hollow needle. But for all this knowledge to transform and illuminate an empire, it had to be copied and shared across 100 different cities in the Islamic world. For this, there was a new invention. One that is still fundamental to learning and knowledge today. Paper.
Around the year 700-750, when Muslim armies reached Central Asia, they encountered paper for the first time. And very quickly, the Muslim bureaucracy started using paper. And you find that, you know, within 50 years, it's in Syria, and then a few years after that, it's in Egypt, and then it's in North Africa, and then it's in Sicily, and then it's in Spain. And that's where Europe learned to make paper from. They learned to make it from the Arabs.
We begin to have people with family names like paper maker. So in other words, it's not only that paper was available, it must have become a very, very widespread industry. And hence, the acquisition of books must have also become very easy.
With the wide use of books and paper, hundreds of scribes, some of whom were women, were kept busy transcribing the translations and new writings of the Baghdad scholars.
All of this knowledge that's being acquired from the Greeks and from the Indians and from Central Asia and stuff is all being written down in books on paper, and that these books are being copied and recopied and sent around. We know, for example, that there was a street of booksellers with more than 100 shops, each one with paper and books for sale. And this is a time when, you know, in Europe, a monastery would be lucky if it had 5 or 10 books.
While the monks of the West were hoarding their wisdom on scraps of expensive parchment, paper enabled Islamic civilization to spread its newfound knowledge far and wide, creating a single community linking 3 continents.
So the chief distinction, therefore, of Islamic civilization, in addition to the fact that it made new leaps of originality, new transformations in traditions of learning and everything else possible, is the fact that it enabled human beings to consider the possibility of thinking about the globe as a single unit, humanity.
In all the broad empire, there was one place the Christian world could experience the lifestyle Muslims now took for granted. Southern Spain. Here, on the European continent itself, Islamic culture would begin to have an effect on the European civilization around it. 1,000 years ago, the Spanish city of Cordoba was a center of learning and culture that rivaled Baghdad. Today, Cordoba's narrow lanes hearken to its medieval past. During the Dark Ages, this was the most prosperous and sophisticated metropolis on the continent. It had streetlights and paved roads, libraries, hospitals, and palaces. This was a city of light. A Muslim city.
The city of Cordoba in the 9th and 10th centuries was one of the biggest and most exciting in Europe. We have descriptions of it by people coming and saying, all these flowers everywhere, this open streets, this wonderful light coming down. Northern cities were dark. Cordoba had running water. People lived in big houses. In contrast, in Paris, people lived in shacks by the side of the river.
The glory of medieval Cordoba is here, in what is now the great Roman Catholic Cathedral in the middle of town. But the Cordoba Cathedral of today began its life as a mosque, one of the grandest of the Islamic Empire.
The Great Mosque in Cordoba was simply the biggest mosque in the biggest city in southern Europe.
When you climb up into the church tower, which used to be a minaret, you look out over this expanse of roof, it's quite amazing to see this cathedral complete with flying buttresses popping up out of the middle of this massive mosque.
Many people came to visit it to view the wonders of the mosque, which had rib vaulting, the kind of vaulting which is like this, and which 100 years later, by a mere coincidence, you might think, but not at all a coincidence, appears in the Gothic cathedrals of Northern Europe. in Lincoln Cathedral, in Chartres Cathedral in France. Where does that come from? Obviously, influenced by the great Mosque of Cordoba in the south of Spain.
For the occasional European Christian traveller, Cordoba was their one opportunity to glimpse the Islamic world. What they saw was shocking. Most of Europe at that time languished in poverty and squalor. Cordoba was a pageant of prosperity and enlightenment.
In the 10th century, there was a Saxon nun with the unpronounceable name of Hrotswitha, who called medieval Cordoba the ornament of the world. She was very, very taken with the place. And there you are, she's a Christian nun.
As Europeans made their way from the cold stone of their northern castles into the glorious Muslim cities of southern Spain, they couldn't help but be impressed. In the green hills above Granada was a palace of startling elegance, a shining example of the richness and sophistication Islam brought to medieval Europe. It is called the Alhambra.
The Alhambra is perhaps the most famous example of Islamic architecture to most Westerners. It is the best remaining example of what a medieval Muslim palace would have looked like.
Echoed in the finely carved geometric plasterwork and marble pillars is a vanished lifestyle of extraordinary luxury. The Alhambra reveals the pinnacle of Islamic culture and urbanity.
The beauty of the Alhambra is not so much in the individual details. No, it's more the combination of everything. That is, this wonderful sort of orchestrated interplay of different textures and surfaces, of light and space and water playing inside and outside of buildings. It's almost like a symphony of different elements that are very carefully brought together to provide exquisite enjoyment.
Here, the Muslim elite relished the good life. Reposing on lush carpets, surrounded by perfume and music, the privileged few debated the nature of God, the subtleties of Greek philosophy, or the most recent mathematical revelations from India, while they dined on spiced delicacies served on Chinese porcelains. They strolled the grounds through gardens irrigated by complex gravity-fed water systems. How far Muhammad's followers had come from the life of desert nomads. How distant they felt from the rest of the European continent they now shared. Christian Europe, due north, was struggling on through the Dark Ages. But at the dawn of the 11th century, a tragedy in Jerusalem would put Muslims and European Christians on a collision course. Jerusalem was ruled by an Egyptian caliph, an infamous man named Al-Hakim.
Al-Hakim was certainly a deviation from the norm. Clinically speaking, I suppose today we regard him as a madman, as someone who is simply insane.
For 200 years, Christian holy places in Jerusalem had been respected and protected by Muslim rulers. In 1009, the Egyptian ruler Al-Hakim broke with that tradition. He ordered the holiest church in Christendom destroyed.
And horror of horrors, he burnt down the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. And nobody knows quite why he did it. And you can have your own theories about it. But the fact of the matter was that that sent shivers of terror and anxiety through Christendom.
In a way, of course, Al-Hakim was the one exception that proved the rule for Christians, that Christians had been speaking of for centuries, of Muslims as intolerant, mad, slavering heretics who simply could not be expected to abide by the rules of civilized human beings.
The fact that Al-Hakim's successor rebuilt the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, it was done by 1048 with Byzantine help, didn't cut any ice. There was this perception now that things were not going well in the Holy Land.
In Europe, anti-Muslim sentiment simmered. By 1095, it reached the boiling point. Pope Urban II spent most of that year traveling through France, imploring his feudal lords to unite in a campaign of bloodshed. "Hasten to exterminate this vile race from the lands of your eastern brethren," the Pope demanded. "Jerusalem is the navel of the world. She cried out to be liberated. Christ himself commands it."
So we've got a merging or a coming together of military service and religion, which served the purposes, if you like, of a pope who in 1095 made his famous call to crusade to rescue the endangered holy places in the East, and in particular Jerusalem.
In 1097, Muslim shepherds in Syria caught their first glimpse of a sight that would soon strike terror throughout the Holy Land. When the Crusaders struck, by sheer chance, the Arab Empire was at its most vulnerable, broken into feuding kingdoms and petty dynasties.
They couldn't have chosen a better moment, because the Muslim world was in a very fragmented state. The great rulers of the time had died, and into that power vacuum there came this most unexpected enemy, the Crusaders from Western Europe. Who would have thought that a new enemy would come to the Islamic world from that unexpected quarter? It was completely unprecedented. It was a real surprise. The Muslims didn't really know who they were. They thought they were just another lot of Byzantines who were coming, as usual, to be a nuisance and fight on the borders. They had no idea that there was this extraordinary surge of religious fervor and fanaticism coming from Western Europe, and that the aim of this group was Jerusalem.
History is haunted by days of incomprehensible horror. Few are darker than July 15, 1099, when the Crusaders entered Jerusalem.
The massacre must have been terrible. The fear, the fleeing of the population, it must have been horrendous.
From a letter to the Pope from the Crusaders: "If you want to know what was done to the enemies we found in the city, know this. Our men rode in the blood of the Saracens up to the knees of their horses."
They saw the holy city, and they were in a state of exaltation. And perhaps that's why, when they flooded through the gates of the city, that they were fired up with fanaticism and zeal, and that's why there was this terrible massacre in the name of Christendom. It was a blot on the name of Christendom. in the Muslim view, and justifiably so.
Even Christians weren't spared. At the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, dozens of worshippers from Eastern sects were massacred. To the Crusaders, they were nothing more than foreigners. The Christian chronicles record the carnage. The Saracens, who were still alive, dragged the dead ones out and made huge piles of them. Such a slaughter of pagans no one has ever seen or heard of. The pyres they made were like pyramids.
They shocked the Muslim world when they came. There are a number of extremely moving lamentations in poetry which date from that period. And the Arab poets of the time talk about the feelings of anguish and terror which the Crusaders, or the Franks as they're called in the Arab sources, caused the local people, the old women, the young girls, those who were cloistered away in their houses, are trembling with fear. The whole imagery is that of the rape of their land and the terrible impurities caused by these barbarian infidels coming into their sacred space.
We have mingled blood with flowing tears, and there is no room left in us for pity. To shed tears is man's worst weapon when the swords stir up the embers of war. When blood has been spilt, when sweet girls must hide their lovely faces in their hands for shame. The First Crusade was over. Of the 100,000 men who began the campaign, most would eventually return to Europe, having had only a glimpse of Muslim life. The job of occupying Jerusalem and the surrounding countryside fell to the 20,000 who remained, indefinitely. To secure their occupation, the intruders did here what they had done in Europe. They built castles.
The Crusaders built the finest castles that the Near East has ever seen. And the proof of that is that they're still there. When everything else may have faded away, the Crusader castles remain a living testimony to their presence. And Krak de Chevalier in Syria is the Crusader castle of them all. It's very, very big, it's strong, it's impenetrable. It's a living example of the way that a number of the Crusader castles couldn't be taken by siege.
You can see for miles and miles from it and see the other castles that would have been, you know, in visual distance for communication by fire and smoke signals. It's got, you know, all the accoutrements of a good medieval castle with battlements and turrets and places for pouring boiling oil and other liquids down onto the enemy.
But inside that castle, what was life really like? It wasn't merriment and festivity. It was constant fear. You had to be on the lookout in case someone was trying to mine the castle or to climb over the walls with scaling ladders. The people outside, the population, the local peasantry, they were not friendly, so you had to watch their movements all the time. It was a terrifying place.
The Crusaders made treaties and broke them. They harassed the traders who passed by their castles. As they raided caravans, the Crusaders learned of a luxurious lifestyle unheard of in Europe.
Well, materially, the Crusaders were just blown away by what they found in the Middle East, and they took a lot of it back with them. Inlaid metalwork, textiles, silks, things like that they had just never seen in such quantities before. The good life. these things they brought back to Europe, some as souvenirs, and in fact it was a whole industry that developed in the Middle East of providing souvenirs for the Crusaders to take back.
It is perhaps a Western bias to imagine the Crusaders were a decisive force in world events, devastating to the Islamic culture and trade. The truth is, while the knights of the Crusades were bunkering down in their castles, Islam was spreading its influence and flourishing. Muhammad's message rang out as clear and strong as it ever had.
Allahu Akbar! Allah!
Mosques were now on every horizon. They welcomed traders. They housed schools and hospitals. Through Islamic architecture, literature, and music, a vibrant culture was emerging in celebration of a singular faith. An empire. Culture was now enlightening it. But ultimately, what united it was trade. For the Muslims, trade, like science, brought innovation. Business was expedited by a revolutionary concept called the saq, a check that could be written in Spain and cashed in India.
Writing a check assumes that someone's going to honor it and cash it at the other end. And that if you give the money or you have the money in one place, that someone will say, I have access to that somewhere else. So this implies that you have some kind of central bank or central loan organization who's going to be good for the money. So it frees up your ability to travel. Money doesn't have to be moved from Samarkand back to Cordoba in order to go back the other way the next year, so that you can base it all on trust and faith. And Muslims became some of the greatest merchants of Middle Ages.
And the greatest craftsmen as well. From the Persians, Muslim blacksmiths learned how to fold steel to give it strength and flexibility. The swords made in Toledo and Damascus have no equal in the world. But the economic backbone of Islam's expanding wealth was textiles. The demand for the products of Muslim looms was enormous, for cashmere, cotton, and silk.
Textiles were simply the gas and steel industry of medieval times. Because you have to think of textiles not only as growing the plants, but making all the dyes, and the dyes that were particularly expensive and imported the farthest. And then you need all the fixtures and wardens and equipment for looms, and then you need to transport these textiles. So collectively, the industry of making and transporting textiles was the mainstay of the economy.
While Europeans settled for coarse woolen and linen garments, Muslims wore brocaded fabrics of organdy, damask, and taffeta.
Well, it goes on for about another 15 minutes. Oh yeah, are all the lights on? That's what we like. I mean, it's like. I think often for many people in the West, this whole era is sort of lost to history. We don't really study that in colleges. For many people, I discover in many places that from the early church fathers, maybe the New Testament, to the time of Luther, there's very little knowledge about the Middle East, about the whole, you know, the empires of the Muslims, the great civilizations that they built, etc., and all the things that they accomplished. It's just kind of a blank. And often Mike, can we turn that? We need to just push the button on the top, on the back, on the right hand side. Just push the button.
Power button?
Maybe. Miles coming. Yeah. There you go. Yeah, okay, thank you. Good. So anyway, just some of your first impressions. How many of you had seen this before? Anybody? You had? Yeah? And you had to. Yeah, okay, So the first impressions of this. The grandeur of it, the vastness of it. Oh, yeah, right.
I guess this is, like you said, this is sort of missing from my education. I just graduated from college, and I never really learned about this piece of history. And I guess I had. The most I've learned about it is from a computer game that I played over the last couple of years called Age of Kings, Age of Empires. And there's a campaign in there about the Saracens and about the Crusaders.
Oh, I see. Yes, right. I think it's important to begin to understand. If you want to understand the Middle East today, that is the Arab Muslim world, you have to understand something about the greatness that was. Because what happened, and we'll look at that more tomorrow, is that all of these great empires, the third set, by the way, is the Ottoman Empire, which was just a great empire, Suleiman the Magnificent. Those of you who are old enough, you remember something about the Ottoman Empire and its collapse after the First World War, the Treaty of Versailles, and the whole Middle East then was carved up by Europeans and so on. All of these great empires, with all of the things that they accomplished in science and medicine, in the arts, in literature, all of this, somehow faded. It almost imploded upon itself. And then the West picked up on this, and the Renaissance sort of started in the West, and the fortunes of history were just reversed. So in the Middle Ages, Baghdad, Cairo, Damascus, these were the centers of learning. If you really wanted to go where the knowledge was, where the cutting edge was, this is where you went. And then that all began to go into reverse. And so the question was then, how have the mighty fallen? How is it possible that we who were so great had such a tremendous empire, such an impact upon, you know, societies at large, all the way from China to France, how have we fallen to such a low estate? And that's kind of the pain we'll look at tomorrow, yeah.
While all this was going on in Europe, the printing press was invented, and movable type, and all of those things that was part of the advance of the European cultures. Right. And apparently that didn't have much of an influence in this area.
Well, as you can see, they had great libraries, right?
Handwritten.
Huh? Yeah, handwritten, but on paper, right? Why was the printing press sort of
printing press came much later, didn't it?
It came much later, yeah. In what, the 16th century, 15th, yeah, the Gutenberg and so on. Why that didn't start, flourish in the Middle East, you know, who knows? Why didn't the Renaissance sort of take hold there after all that glorious history? Why is it that that isn't where sort of the Renaissance and the Industrial Revolution and all this sort of took off, you see? We just don't know. Historians argue back and forth. Yeah.
Well, I was just saying, I mean, the Westminster, the Renaissance, and then the Reformation, and then the Enlightenment, you know, are corresponding movements that really didn't touch the Islamic world.
Yeah, sure. Here you had two kind of empires, you know, actually in touch, but not really in touch, yeah.
They mentioned so they started in 1095, but how long did they really last?
For about, 190 some years, I think.
Almost 1300.
Yeah, Saladin at 1180, 100 years later, approximately, drove out the Crusaders from Jerusalem. But then they still stayed in Acre and in places along the coast. I think they didn't leave there for another almost 50 or 60 years, something like that. So it was maybe at roughly 150 to 175 years that they remained there, yeah.
One of the things I remember when I saw this on PBS, that, I mean, I got angry. I mean, the presumptions that we have of Western culture, you know, that we're the top of the heap, mm-hmm. and if you disagree with us, we'll kill you. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, that whole mindset is so totally not what was going on with these people. I mean, they were merchants. You know, and they were trying to use knowledge for knowledge's sake, and our ancestors were busy killing each other, and being poor and ignorant, and it's like I'm reminded of 9/11 and how we responded, you know, and it's like the echoes of that are scary. They're very scary to me, and it makes me very frustrated because I'm not too sure how much we've learned. Over the centuries, about each other, and we got bigger bombs and bullets now. And I'm not sure that's good.
We do, and now we're the superpower. But it's interesting, you know, as you look at this period, that the Christians who lived under the Islamic Empire wrote very differently about Islam than the Christians of the West, who sort of were the enemies, right? And you say that's very understandable because they were protecting themselves. In other words, if you live under an empire, you can write about it, but you have to be very careful what you write. But I think as you begin to look over the literature historically, there's a much deeper appreciation of who the Muslims really were and what they actually contributed and had. There was a much deeper understanding than in the West, where it was often just vilifying and using very crude language and horrible distortions of what Muslims were, who Muhammad was, etc. So we, of course, are inheritors of that Western tradition. And again, many of us know very little about the Christians who lived under Islam and the writings that they produced. Yeah.
One thing I must think of the Balkans, and the Ottoman Empire was a very brutal regime in the Balkans. The Serbs didn't care for them, and they oppressed people.
The Ottomans?
Yeah.
Depends on which century.
Well, they would take your oldest son.
Yeah.
To give in service to the Sultan, and basically they, you know, exercise political control these areas, and when they had the possibility to overthrow them, they did, which took 500 years.
The Arabs aren't too crazy about them either.
No, the Arabs weren't too crazy, but the Turks, whatever you may think of them, they were good bureaucrats. they really knew how to rule.
For a while, until they became very corrupt.
Well, until they became very corrupt, and then they kind of imploded upon themselves, right. But if you look at the next video, you'll begin to see, and if you study, some scholars have spent their whole life just studying, you know, the Ottoman Empire. And they also learned from others as best they could. They were not so destructive in terms of their conquest. They would be willing to use the best of those whom they conquered and then adapt it to their own ways. I look at the Suleiman the Magnificent and the great structures that they built, the armies that they had, and so on and so forth. These were heady times, and somehow that all imploded upon itself. But I think what we need to sort of remember is that the Arab world, the Muslim world, had this glorious past, and that all faded, and the colonialists came in from the West, conquered, and then, in a sense, the Muslims were incredibly humiliated. And looking back at what was, and then wondering whether that can be restored again in the future. I think this is kind of, you know, this lament. We'll look at that more tomorrow. Have we abandoned God? Has God abandoned us? How long, O Lord, will you forget us forever? And so you want now to sort of maybe recapture some of that past, restore some of that past, that greatness, or just to tip your hat and just move on, you know, and not really worry about it. So you get those two streams. Yeah.
Do the Arabs currently in the Middle East have a sense of that past?
Oh, absolutely, they have a sense of that past. I sometimes liken it to, you know, when you have a party and you get everything nice, right? And then guests come and you're so proud of your house and everything is in place and you've dusted and you've cleaned. And then the next morning, okay, when everything is a mess, guests come and you are so embarrassed. Because you say to them, well, you know, you came at a bad time, right? If you had come yesterday or the day before, everything was nice and clean. Or if you would come tomorrow or the next day, we'll get things back in order. But you just happen to be there now. And I think sometimes, you know, the Arab world feels that way. It's an embarrassing time. It wasn't that way in the past. And inshallah, they say, it won't be that way in the future. In other words, they want to sort of regain their stature, their status in the world. And that's a huge struggle for them. A huge struggle. Well, thank you. And go in peace and serve the Lord. Yes. Here's somebody just loaned me of this book by Karen Armstrong, Holy War, The Crusades and Their Impact on Today's World. Again, a very interesting study of the impact of the Crusades continuing into our time today. In fact, some scholars would say that their impact today is even greater than it was historically at the time they occurred.
They're great stories. They're not the whole story. But it's the side of the story that very seldom gets told or heard. Right? It's always the dark side.
It's not my side.
Well,
if it justifies our ideology, to say it.
Absolutely.
But these scholars are top-notch scholars, you know, they're
giving it time.
John R. and others. You can't get into
it. Do you have time for me to ask you a question?
The fact that they put their name into this and their commentary, I think, speaks
well. We thank you tomorrow.
It's
I wanted to come this afternoon to your talk, but I was taking a hike and some ladies were too slow.
Yeah.
I had to stay.
You know, we've got to stop by and
I took a course on the Crusade 11 college. I can't remember all the names, but there were, the slaughter of Jews were most hysterical, as well as many other things.
Yeah.
But there were armies on both sides. I mean, that was, I didn't really go into the other side. I mean, so
well, I think if you could have gone on now, Salahuddin comes on the scene.
Yeah.
And then defeats them and drives them out.
Uh-huh.
But it was a very different defeat when he came than what the Crusaders did. I mean, there was no slaughter.
You're welcome.
And people were allowed to go. Well, if you wanted to stay, you can stay.
Do you know the name of that film?
You can part of the site for the taxes, right? So it was a very kind of generous conquest of Salahuddin. This is kind of amazed. The Westerners, because they expected the worst, and in fact, it wasn't the worst.
The Crusades were pretty violent, didn't they? I mean, they carried off and attacked Constantinople.
Absolutely.
I mean, it was just
sort of
an outlet.
Yes.
Well,
but the scary thing is, where is the religious base for that violence coming?
Well, at the time, the church was actually very pagan.
Yeah.
I mean, these people could not read the Bible ever. They never saw it in any language they could understand.
Mm-hmm.
So they had no idea what he was saying.
That's right.
I mean, all they had was the Pope was telling them.
Well, we often talk about the violence of Islam, you see. We kind of, we don't talk much about the violence of the Christian church. And
we don't want to look at that.
Our violence, yeah. We don't really want to look at that.
Yeah.
We don't want to look about how we go and kill people in the love and name of Jesus. You know, we don't want to talk about how that has filtered down through the centuries to not just the Crusades, but I mean the whole American patriotic, you know, God bless America.
But I think for some people it's quite shocking, you know. I mean,
oh, it is.
Because
it's not part of the propaganda.
The Western civilization, that we were the bearers of civilization, that we had it all, and the others were just sort of backward people.
Because we learned about the Greeks, you know,
the Greeks.
We don't, and we don't learn anything about South America.
We don't learn anything about South America.
Africa.
Yeah.
You can go to Chuck.
Well, you want to go this way?
Okay, this way.
Yeah, there's the Vespers, and we have to help lead Vespers.
I mean, what's going on in Africa, too, is all another layer of this.
Oh.
Wow. And,